here. Yeah.
The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order state and local government operations, reform, technology, and elections. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3131. Representative Mullery. Representative Mullery, I am going to move your bill. We may not have a quorum yet, but you can explain it, and when we get a quorum, we can finish up with the particulars. You recommended to pass and be re-referred to finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is for the Juvenile Interstate Compact. We're already a member of the Adult Interstate Compact, but we aren't of the juvenile. I believe it's, is it 44 states? 41 states have already joined, and we're one of the few that haven't. It makes it much easier when we're transferring juveniles back and forth that are on paper to be part of this, and also by being part of it, we can have a say in how things are done within the transfers around the country. We had a major play in some of the adult provisions, and so that's the best, and Mr. Merz is here to explain it further.
All right, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ken Merz. I'm a director with the Community Services Division for the Department of Corrections. And as Representative Mullery stated, this is the juvenile compact. We passed the new adult compact approximately 7 years ago. This is being modeled after the adult compact. And it is for the transfer of juveniles back and forth between states, either for their supervision or in the case of a runaway or an absconder.
All right. Any questions, members? Seeing no discussion, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, in taking a look at this, you're saying this is an update. And the question I have, since it's been around for a while, how significant are the changes from what there was before? Are these technical or more substantive?
Representative Mullery or Mr. Merz?
Mr. Chair and Representative. It's a little more substantive. What the reason that they did update the adult compact and now they're in the process of updating the juvenile compact is under the previous compacts, there really was no enforcement of the rules. There was no mechanism to enforce the rule. There was no uniform rules that all states had to follow. And by updating the compact, the attempt is to have a uniform set of rules that all member states will be following so that we all know what to expect from each other. And in addition to that, they will be in the process of developing a national database system so that all of this activity can be tracked on a national level also.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it sounds like in some respects you're adding technology to what you have already been doing, or is there something different also in policy?
Mr. Merz.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. The attempt is to go to an all-electronic system. Currently, all of this activity takes place by paper. It's very labor-intensive, and the hope is, and which we have accomplished on the adult side, is to make it a seamless electronic system.
Thank you. All
right. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3131 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mullery.
I believe it just goes to the floor. I've just talked to Mr. Merz, and in the Senate it went to the floor. There's only a $15,000 thing, and they're just taking it out of their existing.
Representative Mullery, it's going to go to Finance. That's the word we have. So
okay.
Either that or we lay it over. Did you have a choice?
Well,
all right.
At this point, we're not going to.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip number five. We're going to go to number six. If Representative Anzels is here. He isn't here. Another lesson could be learned today. Representative Huntley is not here. This could be a remarkably short agenda. Representative Nelson, of course, is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3168 to be passed and moved to the floor, General Register.
All right. Representative Nelson, to your bill.
And I have an amendment to the bill. It's a technical amendment that was pointed out to me. Mark Shepard emailed me that there was a little problem with the rulemaking part of it. And section or line 1.3, let me first move the amendment, 3168H1A1 amendment.
All right, to your amendment.
On line 1.3, we had left out the telling the commissioner to make the rules. And then on the effective date, it was pointed out that the way the effective date was, because they're making rules and it goes into effect, it was sort of a catch-22 there about if they both came went effective the same date, that you'd be having to make the rules, but you can't make the rules till the bill is passed. So this sets it up so that the rules will be made, and then a year later the bill will take effect. So that's what the amendment does. And
all right. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, we do have a memo from Mark Shepard that rather narrows the scope of the bill, for us at least, to Section 4, Page 3. So I know there may be questions on other parts of the bill, but at least that's why you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's basically what the amendment did, was fix the rulemaking. And it's just about making rules. And I have here Tim Werke from the AGC, who I'm hearing this bill for. And it's about, this bill's about pilot cars and certification for people that do pilot cars for oversized loads. And I will let Mr. Werke explain.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors. Mr. Chair, as Representative Nelson stated, just a quick overview so you have a quick background. This bill was designed with a steering committee of broad stakeholders. And I think you're being passed out a roster of who those members were. We reached out to try to include people who had any cause or involvement in the use of escort or pilot vehicles. And then we worked through a probably an 18-month process of trying to identify protocols and standards that we believe were best practices in the industry to provide training and then a certification for these folks that operate and drive these pilot car escort vehicles for oversized loads. So what you have in the thick document, I believe, is dated January 19th. That is a template. I call it a template of protocols that we hope through the rulemaking process would become the basis for the training and then the basis for the certification for this program. And I know the State Patrol commercial vehicle folks are here, and they'd be willing to testify. They were part of our group. The Department of Public Safety would promulgate these rules, and then the State Patrol, through their commercial vehicle section, would provide the training for this program. And the training would be modeled after their successful, long-standing commercial vehicle inspection program, which is disseminated, I believe, across the state through local educational institutions. And then there is a sort of a recurring training that goes on as well. And our goal was to keep this as accessible as possible and as low cost as possible. And so that's sort of how we see this playing out.
All right. Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. With farm implements getting bigger and bigger, there's concern among implement dealers about the escort vehicles. I see they are not included here in your steering committee. Were they reached out to and asked to be part of this?
Mr. Werke, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a good question, and I should have pointed that out. They were not, but here's for the following reason, because it's important for this focus to be brought to your attention. The permit that is issued by the permitting authority for an oversized load is the Department of Transportation as the permitting authority. You need a permit if your load is of a certain size or weight, and that standard would not change. We would not be casting a net to bring into under the purview of this any folks who are currently not do not need to secure a permit for their movement. So the direct answer is no. that farm implements and other implements of husbandry that currently move without permits, et cetera, are not affected by this at all. These are the oversized, over-dimensioned. Particularly our focus on this was the growth in the movement of large loads like wind turbines with the masts and the blades and those kinds of things. So, no, they're not affected.
All right. Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Nelson, to your motion.
I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3168, as amended, be passed and moved to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Representative Van Zyl. Representative Van Zyl's. Representative Van Zyl's, I'm told that K-12 Finance wants to look at this, so I'm going to move that House File 3008 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. So, Representative Van Zyl's, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Apologize for the voice, but bear with me. House File 3008, briefly, very briefly, deals with Type 3 school buses, which are passenger vehicles. This bill is here because of a rulemaking provision. Mr. Shepherd has drafted an amendment, which I believe you have.
Mr. Shepherd, why don't you, I'll move the amendment, and let's have Mr. Shepherd explain it, for one reason, your voice, and for the other, he may be able to do the job we need to have done at this point. So, Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment is a technical amendment. Under the current bill, there's a rulemaking exemption in Section 3 of the bill, which would not be in a codified statute, and all the amendment does is to move that exemption into a codified portion of the statute. There would still be the substantive effect of it would still be the same. It would just be codified.
All right. And members, we do have a memo on this bill with the narrow focus that the reason why it's before this committee. So I'll move the amendment. Further discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Van Zyl's, anything further to your bill?
No, I really appreciate your support.
Any questions? Representative Kiffmeyer?
I'll defer to Representative Biskins.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, could you ask Mr. Shepherd to explain to us what the effect of the exemption here does with rulemaking?
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the first of all, the exemption in the original bill and the exemption in the amended bill are the same substantive effect. What it does is say that the rules that would be adopted for the physical qualifications of Type 3 vehicle drivers are not subject to the Chapter 14 rulemaking process.
Representative Biskin.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepherd, could you explain what that means? Does that mean that they're just going to sit down at a keyboard and type it up and now it has the force of law? Or explain what that means?
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, and members, if the rule is not subject to Chapter 14 rulemaking, that would mean that it's up to the commissioner to determine what process the commissioner would want to follow in adopting that rule.
Representative Biskins.
So, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, I guess basically that means that there's going to be no requirement for public testimony. There will be no requirement for notice. Basically, they can sit at a keyboard, type up a rule, and now it has the force of law. I don't think that's appropriate personally, but
Representative Biskins, I think we have someone coming up to address that. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. The exemption from the rule was requested by the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services, primarily just to have it happen faster. It's less expensive, if not uncostly, to have an exempt rule. As you guys all know, the entire rulemaking process is cumbersome and expensive, and this is just a way to codify codify a physical qualification exemption that already exists for the big yellow school buses and to make it apply for type 3 buses.
Representative Biskin?
Well, Mr. Chair, it might be cumbersome and expensive, and it should ought to be because it does indeed have the force of law.
All right. Mr. Kelleher?
I have nothing further, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I object to the whole exemption from the rulemaking as well. It may be good for a department, but it's not good for the people. The people that have to follow this have no opportunity for input, and seems to me that it would be good to maybe make a motion here to delete the rulemaking exception.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, on that note, Representative Kiffmeyer, if you look at page 3 of the bill, what we're talking about is on lines 3.28 to 3.31 is the physical qualifications of type 3 vehicle drivers, and the rule is to conform with similar language that I think is on the bottom of page 2.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
So, I mean, it's Mr. Chair, it's not new language, so to speak. It's just conforming what exists for the yellow buses to allow that physical qualification, which has to be done through rule, for the Type 3 vehicles.
Representative Kiffmeyer, is that an amendment that you just proposed, or is it a discussion point?
It was a discussion, Mr. Chairman, and I think that what you're pointing out there and that sort of connection is true, but if that were the case, there is rulemaking that allows you to do expedited rulemaking that is less expensive and a lot more quickly. So I don't think it's necessary to just have a total exemption here, and I think it would be something that if you want to consider that, to just do the expedited rulemaking.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, as I said earlier, I don't really want to take up a lot more of the committee time. This was put in at the request of the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services, and unfortunately they're not here to defend their own rulemaking exemption this morning.
Representative Moore.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I wasn't asking to be recognized.
You weren't?
No, thank you.
Okay, that's Representative Kahn, were you?
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Chairman and members, I usually agree with pretty strict use of the rulemaking process, but in this case, where you're just adding another kind of bus, and actually probably a more easily driven bus, to the rules that already exist for the buses that are harder to drive, and the department has proposed it, I really think that what they're proposing is okay. So I'm not going to join in saying that it go to a strict rulemaking process.
Representative Enzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the end of the day, what we're trying to do is to line up the same rulemaking procedure for Type 3 as with the big yellow buses. And so I ask for your support.
Right. Representative Murrow has made up his mind and now wishes to.
Mr. Chair, I did confirm we do have a representative from State Patrol here, except I'll leave it to the decision of the chair to bring up the representative. But what I can tell you is that the representative from the State Patrol who works for the Office of Pupil Transportation will tell you that the big yellow buses that the Representative Ansel described have a whole set of rules on the qualifications. They're just taking the same rules that apply to the big yellow buses and applying to the little mini yellow buses. The representative from the State Patrol could testify if members need to hear that from the State Patrol, but they are, that is what they would say if they were to testify.
Well, if he's here, why don't we have him come up? Or she, I don't know which one. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Lieutenant Edward Carroll, Minnesota State Patrol.
Could you repeat that one more time, please?
Lieutenant Edward Carroll, right. Minnesota State Patrol.
And go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Representative Morrow, those are, in fact, the rules. We have rules set up for the larger school buses. What they're actually going to do in this bill is just take the rules that we use for the larger school buses and use them for the Type 3 on the driver qualifications. To tell you the truth, in a nutshell, that's what we're going to do. What happened with this bill is, I don't want to go in too far, but what happened was there was no exemptions for a medical certificate for a Type 3 school bus driver. It was something missed when this law was passed. what happened was like a catch-22 type situation where somebody could go get a CDL, get the exemptions under the CDL rules, and then drive a Type 3 school bus, to put it simply. This just fixes that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate that explanation. I think that clarifies it very much so. But I do want to also say that the point was not the validity, but the point was public input. I understand departments. I understand everybody else. But our job, you know, for me, was thinking of the people in my district who wanted to have input into these kinds of things. And so I was speaking for them. That's all. But I think with your clarification, Lieutenant, I think that helps take care of the issue. Thank you.
Representative Nelson does not wish to speak. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3008, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
And Representative Nelson. All right, Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy, there are really two bills here. Which one do you want to take first? We've got an order on the agenda, but I'll go with your preference.
House File 3281.
I will move House File 3281 to be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Omnibus Pension Retirement Bill presented from the Pension Commission. For your consideration, Article 1 is the proposal for sustainability for all plans, which you have heard before at the beginning, pretty much at the beginning of the legislative session, I believe, and the various plans presented their proposed changes, and these are the changes that made it through the Pension Commission. All the plans reduce the annual COLA increases from 2.5% to 2% until they're 90% funded.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
It reduces...
Did you put the delete everything amendment on?
I have not yet. Representative Murphy, is that what you wish to have done?
The 1A?
All right. Members, I will move the 1A, which is the delete everything amendment. And if it looks like this, you can't miss it. And we will put that on now so the bill is in order. All those in favor of the 1A amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is adopted, or the amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, to the bill is amended.
Thank you. And I'm speaking to Article 1. It reduces the interest on deferred benefits to 2% for future years of accrual. It reduces interest rate on refunds from 6% to 4% and eliminates interest on reemployed retiree accounts. The general plan increases vesting requirements from 3 to 5 years for new hires under MSRS. And it extends amortization dates from 2020 to 2040. For the MSRS State Patrol Plan, it increases contribution rates by 0.8% for members and 1.2% for employers effective July 1, 2011. Plus additional state contributions of 10% at a cost of $7 million. And MSRS is currently working with Office of Budget Management to implement a phased approach, and that part is still in negotiation. It increases the vesting requirements for the State Patrol from 3 to 5 years for new hires. and it steepens the early retirement penalties for new hires. The correctional plan under MSRS lowers the benefit per formula from 2.4% to 2.2% for new hires. It increases vesting from 3 to 10 years for new hires, and it steepens early retirement penalties for current employees effective 2015. The PERA plan for the general and correctional plans reduces the annual benefit increases from 2.5% to 1% until the plan is 90% funded. It reduces interest on deferred benefits to 1% for future years. It reduces interest rate on refunds from 6% to 4% and eliminates interest on reemployed retiree accounts. The PERA General and Correctional Plan increases vesting from 3 to 5 years for new hires, except for the Correction Plan, which has a graded vesting, 50% after 5 years, grading to 100% after 10 years. And it increases member contribution rates from 6% to 6.25%, and for employers from 7% to 7.25%, and it revises salary and payroll growth assumptions as recommended by the actuary. For PERA, police and fire, we are recommending to reduce the annual benefit increases from 2.5% to 1% for 2 years, and then to inflation up to 1.5% until 90% funded. We are recommending reducing interest on deferred benefits to 1% for future years, increasing vesting from 3 years to graded vesting schedule, 50% after 5 years, grading to 100% after 10 years. And we are recommending increasing member contributions from 9.4% to 9.6%, and for employers from 14.1% to 14.4%. For the teacher retirement plan, we are recommending suspending annual increases for 2 years, then reducing increases from 2.5% to 2% until they are 90% funded. We are recommending reducing interest on deferred benefits to 2% for future years. We are recommending reducing interest on refunds from 6% to 4%, and eliminates interest on reemployed retiree accounts, and increase contribution rates for teachers and employers by 2% each, phased in over 4 years in 0.5% increments. For the Duluth Teachers Plan, and I would like to state that I'm a member of the Duluth Teachers, so everybody knows. We are recommending suspending annual benefit increases until the fund is 80% funded, and pay 1% increase if the fund is 80% to 90% funded. When 90% funded, we are recommending paying inflation up to 5%. We are recommending to reduce interest on deferred benefits to 2% for future years, increasing vesting from 3 to 5 years for new hires, eliminating interest on reemployed retiree accounts, and increasing member contributions from 5.5% to to 6.5% phased over 2 years, and employer contributions from 5.79% to 6.79% over 2 years. And for the St. Paul teachers on this day, although I understand that there is an amendment to be proposed at a later time, perhaps, we are today we're recommending increasing employee contributions from 5.5% to 6.5% over 2 years, and for employers going from 4.5% to 6.5% increase over 4 years. That is the recommendations for Article 1, Mr. Chair, and I understand that this section limits the growth of planned liabilities by at least $423 million per year.
Discussion, members. Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I don't know if you have the information handy. What would be useful to me as we're talking about the funding levels, you know, we're not going to do any increases until we reach 90%. Where are we at currently with these funds on that journey to 90%?
Representative Murphy, members, I want to recall that we did have a hearing on where these funds were early in session, and we also had at least the proposals from the various groups. So, and the purpose of that was to prepare us for this recommendation. So, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have some of that information with me. It was in a packet like this that I think you received.
Representative Murphy, we did receive that, and we had a full hearing on all of the proposals at that time and where at least the percentages were. This is in our packet. I'm told in your packet there are a series of documents, and I know there's a lot of material in your packet today, members, so you may have to do a little research on your own, but Representative Murphy?
I could quickly read them, Mr. Chair.
All right.
MSRS General, this was as of March of 2009. MSRS was at 65%. MSRS State Patrol was 62%. Correctional MSRS was 55%. PERA, 53%. PERA, Police and Fire, 63%. TRA was at 60%. Duluth Teachers was at 49%, but as of yesterday, they were at 65%. St. Paul Teachers was at 53%.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's interesting, you mentioned the Duluth Fund has improved by, about 16% since, I would assume, March. What's accounting for that rapid increase?
It was March last year. It was a 20...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think all the funds are above that number as of this date because there was a very good investment year. And the Duluth teachers were at 20% increase in this past investment year.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Murphy. I know that all these pension plans have worked very hard to come with a balanced approach to try and do this. It's still a significant amount of money when you look at the individuals and you look at the employers. And nonetheless, I know you've worked very hard. Thank you for that. The only question I have is under the employer additional, under the State Patrol, that's a plus 10%. And my question is that a one-time or there's too much material here to wade through it.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, it's an ongoing cost.
So this is an annual cost?
Kiffmeyer. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Further discussion? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Representative Murphy, are all the stakeholders on involved in this on board with this proposal?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, all the stakeholders are on board. At our hearing at the Pension Commission, the Education Minnesota spoke in opposition to TRA because there was no benefit increases contained therein.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Have you then received a letter word from Ed Minnesota that they are on board, or do they still oppose this legislation?
I have not received word that they have changed their position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, I have no one who requested to testify on the bill unless there's someone who wishes to come up now and testify. Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, do we have a fiscal note yet on this?
Representative Murphy. This is going to finance. That's the motion. So if there is a cost, finance will be looking at it. Representative Murphy, I think what we'll do is take the testifier here, and then we'll go back if you want to answer the fiscal question. But let's take the testifier. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Jody Boer with Education Minnesota, and I wasn't planning to testify this morning, but in light of the question, thought I needed to come up and clarify. Would appreciate the opportunity to talk about a proposal that we presented to the Pension Commission, and that is a 3% contribution increase, which would have our members paying entirely for a benefit equity that we would like to see. We believe that this proposal places too heavy of a burden on our active members, and so I don't want to, you know, I don't need to go into a lot of detail. The Pension Commission heard the proposal, and we've spoke at previous hearings, but I just thought I should go on the record for this committee's benefit that we would welcome the opportunity to continue working with those that are proposing this, but we still do strongly believe that our members have a heavy burden with this proposal as it is. Mr. Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for clarification point, very simply, do you support or oppose this piece of legislation?
Ms. Park.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, we support the proposal and the effort to stabilize the fund. That is one of our priorities for pensions, and it has been, and it was last legislative session, and it remains one of our priorities. So I know you want a yes or no answer. So yes, we support sustaining and stabilizing the fund, Representative Biskins and members. We also do still hold firm that we support a benefit equity, and that is the portion that we would appreciate the opportunity to continue to work through with the supporters of this proposal. Mr. Chair.
All right. Further discussion. Representative Murphy, do you want to answer the other question if there is a, or what the fiscal impact might be?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal impact is that we would welcome new money from the state of Minnesota to put into the sustainability package for every plan. We know it's absolutely necessary to put some money in for Article 12 and 13, the MRF articles. We know that we are in a financial difficulty, to say the least, in the state appropriations, with the state appropriations. I have, and the Pension Commission members each have been talking with leadership and those that set the targets on asking for funding. I have suggested that we could use anywhere from $10 to $50 million or $400 million to solve the problems in this package. That is not realistic. But I have not been told no. And so therefore, I really think that this bill should go to finance and should continue along its way without having a definite amount of money attached to it at this time. But it does take money, and it's not the fault of any of the plans or the investments. It was the United States, a world markets that shocked us and fell in such a quick time. We lost 25% of our investment in 2 months.
All right.
I was shocked.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I wasn't going to say this, but I just say, Representative Murphy, that there were many years where previous retirees got double-digit increases, some of them to the extent that they doubled their pensions. When the recommendations of the pension executive directors and everybody else together came to the legislature and said, these are too rich, you are averaging over 5 years instead of 20 years, the legislature did not take that advice. And those excessive amounts, in the good times, and we understand when the times are good, but those times, we all look back now and just marvel at that. And so that set up the conditions for the second one, which was, of course, these kinds of hits. But the most fundamental one, as you all know in the actuarials, when you look at these numbers, even a slight change has a huge impact. When you look back to those years of double-digit increases for 5 or 6 years, thereabouts, those are took a lot out of the system and also go forward into the future on the actuarials as well. So I think there are one thing, but I think that was a greater impact. A specific question I have for you on this employer contribution of 10%. I know that you're going to go to Finance Committee, but do you have an amount of money that that costs on an annual basis? Is there a dollar number on that? Just interested.
Representative Murphy, do you want it?
About, Mr. Chair, I'm told about $7 million, Representative Kiffmeyer.
All right.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, about the previous statement, you're absolutely right, and we took too long to put the caps at 5% on the cost of living increases or the annual checks or increases that the funds presented to the retirees, and that is why that the Pension Commission very strongly when we were suggested to put this further out, put out these recommendations further out, why we said no, that we have to do it as we have to get new money into the plans as quickly as possible. And we can't wait another year to talk about it and to better inform our members.
Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, and I have no one who wishes to testify on the bill, I'll renew my motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppe.
I'm going to
there's an amendment. All right, please. There is an amendment. Representative Poppe.
I have an amendment in the package. It's LCPR 10-8A, and I maybe will be doing it to both of the bills. I'm not sure which one is more appropriate
Representative
for,
Murphy.
But
Mr. Chair, I think we would do that one. That's your amendment?
One? The amendment.
I think we should do that when we come to Article 15.
All right.
So are we going to...
So, Representative Murphy, you want to walk through more of this amendment? The delete everything amendment?
That's correct.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Murphy, why don't you finish with this, and then we'll go to the Poppe amendment.
Okay.
And...
And then there's another amendment also.
You want that amendment put on now?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Let's get
to
this
the chair
still.
That it's an amendment requested in, by PERA for Article 1 right. On the deferred annuitants. And we're changing the date from 2010 to 2011. I don't see
Representative Murphy, I'll move that amendment as it's passed out. And you just explained it. It's a date change. Is that what the amendment
That's
says?
Correct. And Ms. Vanek can answer questions.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Mary Vanek, the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. We asked Representative Murphy to offer this amendment so that we could extend the date when we change the interest on deferred members. Those are individuals who have left the system, who have earned a right to a benefit, and they are not yet collecting their benefit. And it was recommended that we have a little more time to individually contact these folks because they no longer are in the system and they only receive a newsletter a couple times a year from us. So if we delay this implementation by a year, we can contact them individually and notify them of the change in the benefit structure.
Right. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, you want to continue?
Mr. Chair, Article 2 is an MSRS administrative article. It's a technical cleanup removing the word state from the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan since it's also available to individual or to local governments. It allows reemployed annuitants who participate in the public safety insurance premium tax exclusion to receive enough of their suspended benefits to receive a tax advantage with the federal returns. It extends MSRS leave provisions to the state patrol. And it Section 17 establishes a uniform procedure for all pension plans to correct errors when an individual is reported to the wrong plan, which we hope doesn't happen often.
But we know it does.
Okay.
You can proceed.
Are there any questions about Article 2? Good. Article 3, the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan. Clarifies that employers may submit contributions and data to a record keeper and that the record keeper must follow state data privacy guidelines and cannot solicit for other products. Article 4 is the Minnesota State Retirement System Unclassified Plan. Current employees covered by the unclassified plan will continue to be allowed to switch to the general plan anytime after 10 years of service. It limits unclassified plan employees hired after July 1st, 2010 to elect general plan coverage during their first 7 years of employment. It allows legislators to switch from the unclassified plan to the general plan during their first 7 years, or by January 1st, 2011, whichever is later. Legislators elected after 1997 are in the unclassified plan. A few chose to switch from the legislator's plan to the unclassified plan. This gives legislators the same benefits that other unclassified people have in our system. It ties the unclassified plan employee contribution rate to that of the general plan, which will be 5% on July 1st, 2010. Current employee contributions are 4%. The change is proposed because employees who switch to the general plan must make up the contribution difference between what is paid to the unclassified plan and what would have been paid to the general plan. And it makes technical modifications to incorporate the change from monthly valued funds to daily valued funds and removes obsolete language. Questions?
Representative Murphy, I think you can keep going, and but Representative Gutwald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, when we shift from 3 years of vesting to 10 years in some of these cases, with the amount that people change jobs these days, we're knocking off mostly new people, correct? I mean, that's
Representative Murphy.
You're correct. It's part of the sustainability building. Mr. Chair, Article 5, our PERA administrative provisions, it includes technical cleanup of the definitions of positions that must be covered by PERA and those that are excluded from participation. It reorganizes language allowing the purchase of salary credit and allows employees placed on furloughs to make contributions to PERA on the salary that they would have received but for the unpaid time off requested or mandated by the employer during budgetary savings programs. It modifies local government reporting procedures, authorizes audits of local units of government based on Office of Legislative Auditors' recommendation that PERA should more actively ensure reporting requirements are followed. It allows PERA to impose minor fees or fines to an employer's delay in reporting required data. It adds three new groups to the list of privatized employers, including the Chris Jensen Health and Rehabilitation Center in St. Louis County, the Mental Health Care Unit of Douglas County Hospital, and Wheaton Community Hospital. And it adds the City of Virginia to session laws enacted in 2009 to provide a method of correcting misreported compensation for the City of Duluth. After the special legislation was enacted in 2009, the City of Virginia asked for similar treatment. Article 6 is a volunteer firefighter retirement plan. It's a technical cleanup of the new voluntary statewide volunteer firefighter plan enacted in 2009 to be administered by PERA. Six groups enrolled in the plan effective January 1st, 2010. Article 7 is TRA administrative service credits. It revises the service credit definition so that it more accurately reflects teacher working patterns, eases employer reporting difficulties, and reduces potential for reporting errors. The provision would utilize base salary hours and days worked as the main basis for service credit. Proposal was cost neutral. Article 8 is MNSCU IRAP administrative changes. It authorized MNSCU to contract for investment selection and review services with providers and institutions other than SBI, and it repeals provision that allows MNSCU board to redeem SBI supplemental investment fund shares of members who want to redirect their assets to other investments. Article 9 is actuarial reporting deadlines and extends the deadlines for the retirement systems actuaries to complete and submit their actuarial reports to the LCPR. Article 10 is an early retirement incentive modification. It extends the expiring law, which authorizes an early retirement incentive, and expands the incentive by allowing employers to help finance employee purchase of limited additional service or make a contribution to the employee's post-retirement health care savings account. Article 11 is an optional annuity for retirees after divorce. If a retired member who has elected to take a lower monthly benefit to provide a surviving spouse benefit divorces after retiring, and if the court directs the retired member can receive single life annuity payment, negating the spouse benefit. This can only happen if the parties agree, and this is provided for in the final divorce decree. Articles 12 and 13 are the MRF administrative consolidation that you've already passed out of here. Representative Thiessen's bill. And it provides for administrative consolidation of the MRF fund into PERA, but not consolidation, but just PERA will administrate MRF. And the Article 14 is the volunteer firefighter relief modifications that were recommended by the legislative auditor. And Article 15 is a one-person small group. And allowed a school employee from Invergrove to receive 7 months credit because of an error in reporting. And this would be where Representative Poppy's amendment would come.
All right. Representative Poppy, why don't we go to her amendment now then?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to amend House File 3281 to include LCPR 10-8A, the amendment which allows someone who is a constituent of mine who happens to work at through Minsky at Riverland Community College. She was a person who had been in retirement plans, including PERA and MSRS, and by virtue of getting a job upgrade, an actual change in her job, she was transferred to the IRAP program, and it took nearly 90 days after that happened before someone from the HR department at the college gave her information, and it was not thorough and not very explanatory about what the situation was for her, and she did not realize the consequences to that change until much later and after the year had passed for her to be able to go back into or to choose TRA. IRAP became the default for her. So this amendment is to correct that. It will require her to do the repayment for TRA to be able to buy back the service credit and to do the actuarial amount. It's going to cost her $40,000 or more to be able to do that. Ask for your support. This is something that is going to cost her quite a bit of money to be able to go back and to be able to say she receives the TRA benefit. But based on her past experience that she had been a retirement plan person, this should have been done much earlier, and she should have received better information to make a decision, and it's by virtue of a number of things that didn't happen, and I would appreciate your support to be able to put this amendment into this bill.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, we talked about the individual and talked about it under other circumstances at the Pension Commission, but there was still some hesitancy about if it was Mr. Bergstrom or Ms. Vanek or TRA, somebody testified about the precedent and that the other cases that would be sitting out or other situations that would be sitting out there. I don't know. That was not to this amendment, however, and so I don't know if this is okay now or not. People are shaking their heads.
Representative Murphy, we have someone who may be able to clarify that. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman. Luther Thompson from TRA. Yes, when this was discussed earlier, there was a sharing from the employer, and there was the requirement of the repayment of refunds. This particular bill clears up many of those issues. TRA and the other funds do support it. The member does pay for the entire amount.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the amendment? Does that clarify it? Representative Murphy?
I have no objection.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Further discussion to the bill.
Mr. Chair, Article 16. Article 16, Hennepin County may establish a retirement plan for their employees. Hennepin County Medical. That concludes the summary of the amendment. Or, yes.
The bill.
Summary of the amended bill.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, I have a question about the exemption in Article 16. And it's an exemption to the general prohibition on public employers establishing primary or supplemental retirement plans for their employees. Could you give just a little more information on that? That's new to me on this particular day.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Martin can explain.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. The provision that you have here is not a new authorization. This is simply adding a cross-reference to a special authorization that was done by the legislature 1 or 2 years ago. Since 1971, there has been a general prohibition on local government or state agencies creating new pension plans. There have been a number of exemptions or exceptions to that. Some 16 of them. There was another exemption created for special plans created by Hennepin County Medical Center a couple of years ago, but that exception is found only in the Hennepin County chapter of Minnesota statutes, not in the general prohibition, the normal list of exceptions. So this is simply adding that exception to this list so that there's no confusion.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you have 16 exemptions, how many are left to go before this is not even applicable anymore?
Mr. Martz.
Mr. Chair, the exemptions usually relate to supplemental plans, some union pension plans, also a correction or a clarification that doesn't apply to health coverage plans. So the exceptions are really generic more often than not and are more of a clarifying nature. Since the term pension plan is not defined, the exceptions essentially do define it to basically boil it down to what we would conventionally think of as a defined benefit pension plan.
All right. Any further discussion? Anyone else wish to testify on the bill as amended? All right, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3281 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Murphy, I think we have the next bill, 2952, and I will move that 2952 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. Is there an amendment for that bill also? Or are we?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
5A amendment.
I will move the 5A amendment. And members, out of courtesy to the author, let's put the 5A amendment on, and then she can explain the bill from the 5A amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, two-year bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, this is the sustainability bill, Article 1, separate from the 16, and so we just want to have another opportunity.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of House File 2952 as amended be recommending to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Murphy, thank you. You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for your patience and for allowing me to practice.
Representative Huntley. Representative Huntley, I'll move that House File 3279 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. We do have a memo on your bill that sort of narrows the scope of why it's before us. So if, if we could first address the memo, which I hope you have. We're looking at a couple of sections of the bill, and that's why it's here.
Mr. Chair and members, this relates to health information exchange, and the federal government passed a bill in last year, 2009, which basically mandates that states set up a system by which health information can be exchanged from one clinic or hospital to another clinic or hospital, and that they all have to be interactive and have the ability to use different computer systems and so on. And if we do a good job of this, Minnesota providers will get a higher reimbursement on Medicare, probably in the order of $400 to $800 million. The part that relates to this committee is setting up a board to oversee the information exchange organizations to make sure they're doing what the federal government says they should be doing. And with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Golden to give you any details.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Director of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health. I think Representative Huntley's explanation was actually quite good. As part of the federal stimulus package, there was a portion of that that supported e-health, the ability of hospitals and clinics to be able to exchange information to help deliver better care to patients. What this bill is doing is ensuring that we have a framework in Minnesota that allows the organizations that facilitate that exchange to be able to do that. The two portions of this that are within this committee on the memo are the Oversight Board, which helps advise on the organizations that are doing this to make sure that they are meeting the criteria that are in the other parts of the bill, as well as a rulemaking provision, which is there to ensure that if we need to change the requirements to stay in compliance with federal law, which we anticipate to be modified and refined in 2013 and 2015, that we have that ability. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Right. Discussion. Representative Gutwall.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley and Dr. Golden, here we go again. Issues of privacy and data privacy have not been answered in this bill, to my understanding. I'd like to hear testimony to the contrary if that's available, but that's one of the big issues. I'll let you answer that.
Mr. Golden?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, with regard to this bill, it makes absolutely no changes to Minnesota's consent requirements that exist in statute today. So for a healthcare provider to exchange any patient health information, even with another healthcare provider, they are required to get the patient's consent. That is already current law in Minnesota Statute 144. This bill maintains that. It doesn't matter if that information is moving on paper or electronically.
Representative Gutwell.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Golden, my question at this point is, we have a number of people who've testified on this particular piece of legislation and related legislation that they have concerns about this. Have their questions been answered? Are they feeling good about this?
Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, yes, we have had many conversations with those individuals, and we are very close to resolving all of their concerns.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, the other concern I have, I think Representative Thiessen mentioned it last night. I know your statement, I think, was I'll do anything to get federal money. And I think his response was we shouldn't be setting policy to go after federal money. So I know that was the premise as you introduced this bill before committee, but I have some concerns about that as well.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, Minnesota already has probably the strictest laws on privacy protection of health records of any state, and there's nothing in this bill that changes that privacy protection.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, why do we need this oversight board?
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, the board is needed to make sure that all these groups that are running the exchanges can communicate with each other. Right now, there are two groups that do this, one in the metro area and one in my part of the state. Actually, the one in my part of the state actually goes to Wisconsin and all across northern Minnesota. The question is, can they exchange information between them? For instance, if I have a massive chest pains in a few minutes, which I don't think I'm going to have, but they take me down to Regents Hospital two blocks from here, I would like for them to be able to get my medical records out of Duluth. And so the purpose of this board is to make sure that all these groups that are in various parts of the state can communicate their information back and forth.
Representative Emmer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I don't know that that answers it. I mean, it actually tells me we don't need another board. They can actually do this on their own. The technology has improved. You're telling us that it doesn't have anything to do with privacy considerations, although some of us have some concerns about e-health records, and yet we know that's the direction we're going. So to suggest that this board is going to somehow improve what these organizations can already do on their own, this is just, when are we going to figure out that this more government stuff that we keep creating does nothing more than create more government? It doesn't solve the problem. Let's let them do it. I still don't understand why we need an oversight board for people to do what they already are very well aware in statute and other rules that have been created that they need to do.
Representative Huntley, or Mr. Golden.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, as part of the stimulus package, Minnesota's healthcare providers are eligible for Medicare and Medicaid incentives. In order to achieve those incentives, they have to become meaningful users of electronic health records. To use the electronic health records, they have to do three things. They need to use certified technology. That certification is done by the federal government. They need to report quality measures to CMS or to the Department of Human Services, and they need to exchange information. One of the responsibilities that the federal government is giving to the states is to have oversight over that exchange, and the reason is to ensure that the state oversight can comply, make sure that a state can comply with all of the state privacy laws, which vary quite a lot across the country, and one of the explicit responsibilities is to have governance and accountability, primarily to ensure that the different organizations that are doing these exchanges are exchanging information with each other, and that we don't have artificial barriers that prevent the information from flowing from one hospital to another.
Representative Emmer?
Mr. Chair, that doesn't help me. You just named three things that, frankly, can be done already without you, with the exception that apparently to get some of this wonderful stimulus money yet again, we have to create an oversight board and follow some federal mandate. Again, this is not necessary. And I appreciate what everybody tries to do, that we think we're creating something that's going to do wonderful things in terms of making sure that our medical records are instantaneous whenever Representative Huntley has his massive heart attack. But the reality is they already can do this stuff, and they're moving in that direction. We don't need more government oversight in this black hole of accountability, which is apparently being created to draw in more of our own money, this stimulus money. And these are just not good ideas. But thanks for the discussion.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The concern I have in what you're saying here is, I think, explained somewhat on page 6, lines 17 to 20, where it says that the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board may disclose data classified as protected, non-public, or confidential. In other words, the heck with all the rest of our laws. If they want to, this board can disclose this data classified as protected, non-public, or confidential. and the commissioner jointly determines that disclosing this data will protect the health or safety of patients. So this kind of takes any of our current protections and it just wipes them out because this board can disclose that data just by a sheer vote. And not only that, you've got a situation where here in rulemaking, you don't even have to have a public hearing on rulemaking. You're using expedited process where there's no public hearing. This is really, really important. But just the mere fact of this 617 to 620 means they can just overlook any of our protected laws that you've talked about. So maybe there's something to explain this, but it seems quite explicit here to me.
Mr. Gold.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I think it's probably important to understand what 617 is actually doing. So if you look at 612, this is where the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board is considering a suspension or a revocation of someone's certificate. The reason for that is that they are not complying with the requirements associated with a health information organization, or they are operating outside of their application that they have submitted. The reason for having the ability to release non-public data is it's not that it is patient data that is being released, but it is information that might be dangerous to patients. And let me give you an example of that, committee members. The VA has a electronic health record that allows them to exchange information between all of their various hospitals. They have recently had a problem where the information that was being exchanged was not complete and not always the correct information for the patient. They sent out a memo to all of their hospitals that said, please don't exchange this way. The type of situation that this is anticipating is when the board becomes aware that there might be a problem within one of these organizations that is passing information that is not correct about a patient or is otherwise having a problem. And so this is really to be able to tell those providers that there is an investigation that is looking at this and to be on alert for that. I would also just point out that the information that is not public in 617 through 620 is ultimately made public in 621 through 624 at the conclusion of the investigation.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, one of the things that I appreciate that explanation in that in this context, but here is the issue sometimes that when you go through the legislative process, that next year there'll come an amendment to some of these things, and then it kind of has a creeping effect. And I think the most important thing is the concern that I have that the slippery slope kind of a thing. I think there are many good things and many good reasons why electronic data and records are a lot of good things, but the real thing is in the details and also the future. So what starts out as rather innocuous later on becomes sometimes an issue. So I appreciate for this particular context as it is right now, but I just want to express my concern is also for the future when this could be expanded.
Representative Kahn.
No, I'll pass.
All right, any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3279 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Members, the last bill we have is House File 2958, and I want to have the department come down. This is a department bill. And the chair put the bill in for the department. And as I understand it, there was some controversy over the bill. There's a delete everything amendment. I'll move the delete everything amendment to DE2. And the chair would appreciate that amendment being put on and then for an explanation of the amendment. And I would hope that all controversy is resolved because the chair does have a policy about controversial delete everything amendment. So I'll move the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Barak-Pensky. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. And one of the things our office does is provide advice on the open meeting law and data practices. And the open meeting law was set up to allow transparency so the public could really see decisions happening.
So much has happened in case law that it is really difficult for members of the public to read the statute and really understand who it applies to and what it means to them in the way of access. So having heard from our customers, we are trying to take that case law and codify it in the statute. So what we've provided is some key definitions of terms, and that is where most of the discussion among the local governments and the newspaper association and the department has really centered, around the definition of what is a meeting and who is a public body, because those terms were left undefined in the current statute. Some of the other things that we do in this bill is require that a legal basis be provided when a meeting's going to be closed. There's been case law around that, and that's where the current standard is. We also amend some posting requirements. I think after September 11th, there are so many more meeting rooms of public bodies that are not really generally open anymore, so that when those meeting rooms are behind kind of secure locations, what we want is meeting notices to be posted in areas that are generally accessible to the public. And then we make some clarifying changes also around special meeting notice needing to be 3 calendar days. Right now it just says days, and we get calls every single day about what does a day mean. So to be make that clearer. We also, in Section 5 of the bill, provide an ability, and this is also based on an Attorney General's opinion from 30 years ago, provide the public with the ability to record or photograph open meetings in a way that is not disruptive to the meeting as reasonably determined by the public body. We have had a situation in a couple different spots in the state where public bodies have been trying to say there are going to be special rules for the media when they want to photograph or record, or they're banning all, you know, kind of equipment by citizens. And we wanted to just make it really clear that this is a right that the public has to be able to come to meetings, listen, and photograph and record it should they want to.
All right, thank you. The motion is to send House File 2958 to the General Register. The amendment is on. I understand that there was, Mr. Shepherd, is there one other little amendment we need to adopt? Or Deb Dyson, I'm sorry, I didn't even see the change. Ms. Dyson.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't know of any.
You don't know of any. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on the bill as amended? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Hanfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I just want to reiterate what Ms. Byer-Prensky has said. This is a good bill. It's incremental. It does some fairly minor things in the scope of the open meeting law, but it's mainly going to help citizens in terms of understanding better from the statute what the courts have established as part of the open meeting law over 20 or 30 years. So we think it's a really good initiative, and it's going to be very helpful, mainly for citizens. I just want to be clear to the committee and the chair that there are a couple of very minor sort of wordsmithing issues. It's still exist, but we're all working together very happily, and these aren't going to be a problem for the bill. And let me put it this way, Mr. Chairman, because I know about your policy. I know very well about your policy, and if I didn't know well about your policy, your facial gestures would cause me great anxiety, as they are. I think, and this is simply my position, I'm not telling the chair of the committee what to do. This bill should move forward. It's very well worth moving forward. And if it's a matter that the wordsmithing is going to interfere with that judgment, I'm not going to worry about it, okay?
to everyone, I'm not going to wordsmith this on the House floor. So this is where it's going, to the General Register. So if we're going to continue this discussion on the House floor, I think everyone knows where this bill is going to stay over the interim. Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that policy, and there's another body we have some options with, too.
Mr. Atherton, where is this bill in the Senate? Don't say it's on the floor. It's on the floor.
I think it is.
Mr. Chair, it's on the floor.
There's a word I use in my classroom. I made it up. It's called bogality. And we're reaching my bogality point right now, which means bogus. It's a long definition I use for students, but I'm getting very close to it. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little concerned about something that looked like it was a good idea in the original bill that isn't in the delete anything amendment, because this is something that's come up on the first, looking at the general, the bill, lines 111 to 115, which defines that a meeting doesn't include the participation of any members of a public body in an online form accessible to all members of the public, such as, this has come up in one of the online blogs that I follow. I thought it was kind of ridiculous. I thought the implication that it was a violation of the open meeting law was kind of ridiculous.
Representative, we're working off the delete everything.
I know, but the point is this is something that's all come right off the bill and isn't in the delete everything, and I want to find out why, because I think it was a
Ms.
good Beyer, thing in the bill.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, we thought we'd throw out the idea. Right now the case law says a quorum of the body, you know, transacting public business. So clearly, we already have an advisory opinion from the commissioner that says if the quorum starts emailing and making decisions, that's a violation of the open meeting law. We wanted to see, is there an ability to use something, as long as it was transparent, would it, you know, kind of meet everyone's need to have enough transparency to allow some kind of communication by members? I think it was not ready for prime time, but I thought there was something worth throwing out there as a discussion item. But we have since pulled it out.
Kahn, that's why it's taken some time to even get to this point.
So the example, so the idea is even if they're not, if they're just participating in a, I mean, I never quite understood why participating in a public, why a member of a public meeting would say they couldn't participate in a public blog because there might be a quorum of the other members on it. And this seemed to clear it up. Is it considered that that's no longer necessary?
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I think that there's likelihood, depending on what the content of the blog is, that if it's not purely personal, if it is the public body's business, that if a quorum of them are all on there talking, that that can violate the open meeting law, that that would still be the standard just as it is now.
Representative Kahn.
How do you even know? If they're all entered as members of the blog, doesn't that mean that they're all on it?
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think the problem of whether or not members have always been either gathering in person or at a coffee shop or online, you know, has always occurred. And I think now with electronic means, we have an ability through emails or cell phone records to actually prove that members are doing it. So I think with, you know, certainly that could happen and people might have a difficulty proving it, but they might be able to say, you know, Representative Kahn blog and be able to see a couple other people on there and know that you were transacting business and be able to prove it.
Further discussion.
Okay. Is this in, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
Is this language still in the Senate bill?
Mr. Atheson.
I defer to. I don't, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it is, but it's so, pretty much the same bill.
The Senate bill is the delete everything amendment. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, members, with a few minor changes.
Are the minor changes, Mr. Atheson, the changes that you were wordsmithing? Apparently not, because you said you were still working on it, but I'll ask it anyway.
Mr. Chairman, they're not, but I want to be clear. The wordsmithing issues that I am talking about are not significant enough to cause me any desire to hold this bill up. It's better that the bill go through as it is in the form that you have it before you today as opposed to the Senate bill than not. So it's a good thing for the public in terms of its present form.
So, Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, you would also support the language in the Senate bill over the delete everything we just put on? Or?
Mr. Chair and members, we've had a number of different additions that we've incorporated based on local and newspaper feedback, and the Senate was the agreement that we had of 2 weeks ago. We have also since incorporated more changes from the newspaper perspective into this DE. So I think the House version would be preferable to what the Senate language is right now.
And Mr. Chairman, I want to corroborate that. This is the better version of the bill. This represents pretty much the current agreement among the stakeholders.
All right. Representative Gutwell.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, are there any opponents to this bill right now?
either Mr. Atheson or Ms. Byer-Krinsky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have had Rich Neumeister testify that this incorporates current case law, and he would certainly like to urge the bodies to go further than current case law and provide more openness and more clarity. I have not just been able to get the stakeholders to that point.
Representative Gutwall.
Now, Mr. Chair, as a journalist and a former city council member, I know we've dealt with a lot of these issues, especially the electronic issue came up a number of times in my 9 years, and I think it's a good piece of legislation with deference to the concern about wordsmithing. I would have the same concern, but it's a good piece of legislation.
Ms. Byer-Kipinski, can you tell me when the Senate bill made it to the Senate floor? You have a...
Mr. Chair, members, it came out of committee on President's Day. So was that February 15th?
Yeah, and
January.
Yes, and I think I introduced the bill on February 15th. So it's interesting that the Senate moved very quickly, and I wanted the groups to work it out before we got to committee so that we'd have a better version. So it is an example of the Senate moving much faster, and having them work it out, I think, is a better procedure. So, members, I'm going to leave it up to you. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2958 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Poppe.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the approval of minutes for March 16th and 17th.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.